from Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! The first primary is coming up in New Hampshire. Today we'll speak with representatives of the Al Gore and Bill Bradley camps. Also, Elian Gonzalez's grandmothers will see Elian today in neutral territory in Miami after the Justice Department ordered the child's distant relatives in Miami to comply with the order. And why was Canada's health minister pied in the face? A look at talks on biosafety and genetically engineered organisms in Montreal. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Huntsville, Texas, the death penalty capital of the Western world. Last night, a man was put to death for a fatal shooting he committed at the age of 17. Glenn Allen McGinnis was executed by lethal injection. The Vatican, the European Union, the American Bar Association, and death penalty opponents had pleaded for the life of the 27-year-old. They raised objections to the execution because McGinnis was a juvenile at the time of the crime. He also came from a troubled background. His mother was drug dependent. He was raped and beaten as a child. The execution is the sixth this year in Texas, which leads the nation in capital punishment. Once again, another execution carried out as George W. Bush campaigns in Iowa and New Hampshire. After a day of lobbying lawmakers, the grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez are eager for their planned reunion with their grandson today in Miami. The women met yesterday in Washington with members of Congress who support their desire to return Elian to his father in Cuba. Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, a Democrat, is among those who want to block legislation that would give the six-year-old boy U.S. citizenship. Dodd says Congress shouldn't be interfering in the boy's fate. And Democratic Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Houston, Texas, says meeting with the grandmothers reinforced her view that Congress shouldn't be involved in the case. Editors and reporters at the Florida Times Union have written a letter of protest about an editorial in the newspaper that said slavery had, quote, existed briefly in America and that, quote, its effects are not permanent. The January 10th editorial ran under the headline, "The Lingering Issue," and questioned the need to continue affirmative action in Florida, mentioning Florida Governor Jeb Bush's plan to eliminate racial preferences in state university admissions and state contracting decisions. The editorial said Congress justified affirmative action 35 years ago to make up for past wrongs. Among the wrongs was slavery, which existed briefly in America but ended more than a century ago, the editorial said. Went on to say, however, while it's unfortunate that people from Africa were slaves in 18th century America, it was not unique. This news from Vienna, Austria. The leaders of Israel and Sweden joined today in the chorus of foreign concern about the possibility that Jörg Haider's far-right party will participate in Austria's next government. Late yesterday, Viktor Klima, Austria's caretaker chancellor, announced that his Social Democrats were abandoning efforts to form a minority government, increasing chances that Haider's party will be part of the next government coalition. And despite a snowstorm, more than 1,500 people crammed inside Vermont's State House last night to offer their opinions on whether gay marriages should be recognized in a state that has grabbed the spotlight on the issue. My brother David Goodman was there.
Vermonters braved a major snowstorm last night to fill the State House in Montpelier for the first major public hearing on a proposal to legalize same-sex marriage in Vermont. The public hearing follows by 1 month a decision by the Vermont Supreme Court, which ruled that gay and lesbian couples were entitled to all the legal protections and benefits that heterosexuals enjoy in marriage. They then ordered the state legislature to come up with a solution by rewriting the marriage laws. This would make Vermont the first state in the nation, if it does legalize marriage, to have allowed gay couples to be legally recognized. There are presently two bills pending in the Vermont State Legislature, one to legalize marriage and essentially put it on the same footing as heterosexual marriage. The other is to create a domestic partnership law, which will provide gay couples with legal status but will not allow them to be married. Last night's hearing, virtually all advocates of same-sex marriage rejected the domestic partnership as a form of separate but equal status and they spoke in favor of legalizing marriage outright. Many of the advocates of gay marriage recalled Vermont's history, in which it was the first state in the nation to outlaw slavery. Indeed, the Supreme Court in Vermont has written that this is one of the most important legal decisions in its history. There was a conscious and palpable sense of history in the State House chamber, as one person after another, many of them gay couples themselves or gay people who had been living in the closet for many years, spoke of their frustration and pain at not being able to marry their partners. Opponents, many of them from churches, a number of them read from the Bible to explain their opposition to gay marriage. There was a rally called by the Catholic Bishop of Vermont to go on concurrently with the hearings inside. It was to take place outside the State House. Because of the major snowstorm, the rally was canceled. Instead, however, a number of clergy, representing 82 clergy people, came, wrote and appeared and spoke in favor of same-sex marriage that included the Episcopal Bishop of Vermont and the Methodist Bishop, who have publicly disagreed and broken with the Catholic Bishop of the state. One gay clergyman in particular spoke of his frustration at being able to perform civil marriages for his parishioners, but being unable to marry his own partner many years. There is another hearing scheduled for about a month from now. The date has not been set, and a decision by the legislature on whether to legalize same-sex marriage in Vermont is expected probably in April. This is David Goodman in Montpelier for Pacifica Radio.
When the idle poor become the idle rich, you'll never know just who is who or who is which. Won't it be rich when everyone's poor relative becomes a rocker relative and palms no longer itch? What a switch when we all have heard.
And we'll be going to talk about the New Hampshire primary in just a minute. But before we do that, today's headline story, the Miami relatives of Elian Gonzalez say they'll comply with a Justice Department order to bring the six-year-old Cuban boy to a neutral location today to meet his grandmothers, who flew to the U.S. from Cuba last week in an effort to take him back home with his father. Elian Gonzalez was found last November 25th clinging to an inner tube in the Atlantic Ocean after the makeshift boat he was in with his mother and other would-be immigrants sank. His mother drowned. Elian was taken to distant relatives' home in Miami, where he's remained since. His Miami relatives refused to return the boy to his father in Cuba, prompting a tug-of-war between Cuban exiles in Miami and the Cuban government. After the INS ruled that Elian should be sent back to Cuba, his Miami relatives decided to appeal to a federal court. Several members of Congress are looking at enacting a private law that would make Elian a U.S. citizen to prevent him from being sent home. We're joined right now by Cuban-American attorney Jose Pertiera, immigration attorney. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, can you just give us a quick synopsis of the latest? I've even heard that CBS is doing a miniseries on the life of Elian Gonzalez. Probably will be longer than Elian's life up until this point.
Yeah, I read that too, and it's evident that the manipulation of this little six-year-old boy is getting worse every day. It's very important that he go back to Cuba as soon as possible. He really hasn't had a chance to mourn the death of his mother or to be with the relatives that he grew up with. You know, you got to remember that the relatives in Miami, you call them distant relatives, you're absolutely correct. These are great uncles, second cousins, third cousins. These are people that if he met at all before, he met them for a week last year when some members of that family went to Cuba on a vacation. This is not a custody dispute. A custody dispute is when parents fight over the custody of their child. This is not a fight between parents. This is a case where some distant relatives were given temporary care of the boy as babysitters until such time that the boy could be returned to Cuba, and then these distant relatives have absolutely refused to hand them over. You know, if any one of our children was left in the care of a distant relative for a couple of days, and that distant relative refused to hand him over, we'd call the police. We wouldn't call a child welfare psychologist and turn it into a custody dispute. You know, it really baffles the mind how this case is being played out as if it was a custody dispute, because under the law, if it resembles anything at all, it resembles a kidnapping.
What about the role that the Clinton administration is playing right now?
Well, the Clinton administration, as it is done through its entire 8 years of existence, has, on the one hand, said the right things, but on the other hand, it hasn't done what it needed to do to implement their decisions. In this particular case, the Immigration Service correctly determined that the family in Miami couldn't speak on behalf of the boy, and that the boy, being only 6 years old and recently turned 6 years old, was unable to speak for himself. And so they determined that the only person legally authorized to speak on his behalf was his father. Now, given that decision, the Immigration Service had, as a matter of law, the power to implement the decision to pick up the boy, revoke the temporary care that they placed him under, you know, with these distant relatives, and hand the boy back to his family in Cuba. But the Clinton administration refused to do that and instead virtually invited the family in Miami to sue the government in federal court. The family in Miami, through their lawyers, reluctantly sued. And I say reluctantly because they know that as a matter of law, they have no standing to sue in federal court because they can't speak on behalf of the boy. And if you notice the caption on the federal district court case, it says, Elian Gonzalez versus INS. Well, any lawyer knows that if you're going to represent somebody, you need that somebody to authorize you to represent them. You just can't represent them because you're a lawyer. And in this case, the proper authorization can only come from the father, and he doesn't want the boy to remain in the United States. So the case is going to be thrown out on lack of standing. It's also going to be thrown out because, as a matter of law, there is no judicial review of Immigration Service decisions in cases of this type. The Republican Congress in 1996 and again in 1997 took away any form of judicial review in cases of this type. So
will it change if Elian is made a U.S. citizen? Because it doesn't look like
president. It would dramatically change if he's made a U.S. citizen, because that would strip the Immigration Service of jurisdiction over this case. It would put the case in the hands of an elected state judge in Miami to have a so-called custody case heard in Miami. But since there are no allegations that this father is unfit, the only thing that would be tried in Miami in front of this elected judge is Cuba. And, you know, that's really a misuse of the judicial system. Custody courts are not in the business of deciding which is a good country or a bad country. They have to decide who is a good father and who is a bad father. And that's not what this case is about. What they want is to be able to put Cuba on trial in Miami as a political show and turn this even more into a political circus, all at the expense of a little six-year-old boy and the relationship with his father and his four grandparents and the wealth of other relatives that he has.
Finally, Jose Percheira, since this is a day we're focusing on candidates, particularly the Democratic candidates, and one of them happens to be the Vice President of the United States, what is your view of Al Gore's stance on this issue? I believe that he has said that the father should come to the United States to deal with this, and has seemed to back off a little what the Justice Department is saying.
You know, I'm very disappointed with Vice President Gore's remarks, and I'm very disappointed with all of the presidential candidates' remarks with this case. It seems to be political pandering to a small minority of Cuban Americans, and I speak as a Cuban American myself when I say this. It's a small group of Cuban Americans in Miami that are orchestrating this case, and our presidential candidates should be leaders in this and recognize that they should do the right thing, that the United States government should do the right thing in this case. And the right thing doesn't mean pandering to a bunch of fanatical Cuban Americans in Miami. The right thing is to reunite this boy with his father. And if a presidential candidate came along and said that courageously, I think the American people would back him, and because they would recognize that he's a leader. And so far, I haven't seen any leadership on this issue from any of the presidential candidates.
Well, we will continue to follow the Elian Gonzalez issue. I want to thank you, Jose Pechera, Cuban-American attorney, immigration attorney in Washington, D.C. In fact, it was Jose Pechera on Democracy Now! Who had said a few weeks ago, it's hard to believe this has continued this long, this case around Elian, that the grandmothers should come up to this country to get their grandchild. And here they are in the United States. Not clear, though, that they will be bringing home their grandchild to Cuba. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to the candidates. Today we'll be talking representatives of both Bill Bradley and Al Gore. Yesterday we spoke with representative of Alan Keyes as well as Texas Governor George W. Bush after the Iowa caucuses. Now in the New Hampshire primary race is in full throttle. We're joined right now by David Shea, who is press secretary for Al Gore in California. Of course, Vice President Gore is right now in New Hampshire. The abbreviated race there is shaping up on the Democratic side as, in Bill Bradley's words, a whole new ball game has begun, with Vice President Al Gore seeking opportunities to hitch himself to President Clinton's economic coattails. Gore, who boomerangs between shunning President Clinton and embracing him, has settled on the latter in his attempt to win next week's New Hampshire primary and deny Bradley any comeback from his sound defeat in Iowa. Before meeting Gore tonight for their last pre-primary New Hampshire debate, Bradley is campaigning at a YMCA daycare center to promote his agenda for middle-class working families. The vice president is reaching today for credit for the 1996 welfare reform that congressional Republicans pushed and President Clinton signed. The theme of Gore's noontime appearance at the Electropack Company was timed, aides said, to dovetail with expected news from the White House about Clinton's proposed budget for new welfare-to-work investments. David Shea, why don't we, though, go back first to deal with the issue of Elian Gonzalez. You heard Jose Pechera's criticism of the vice president on this issue. What exactly is his stand? Does he believe Elian Gonzalez should return home?
Well, you know, that's not something, I mean, from an administration standpoint, I mean, the issue is, you know, not clearly something that, you know, I should go into. Vice President Al Gore said, you know, what he has said on the issue, and I'll just leave it at that.
And what exactly has he said?
Well, you know, obviously he wants to, you know, as the right thing needs to be done, and, you know, everybody wants to look out into the best interest of, you know, the family, and that's all that I can go in on that. But I'd like to, you know, talk to you a little bit more about specifically, you know, the campaign and the energy and the enthusiasm that Al Gore has, you know, showing. We are extremely excited about the you know, potential and the possibility of moving this campaign into a real great, you know, time into New Hampshire to talk about the issues. We're energized by the Iowa results, and we're going to keep fighting every day.
There's no question the vice president had a big win in Iowa with, well, at least 2-1 vote. Two to one vote against Bill Bradley. But I do want to stick with this issue because it's a very critical one. We've talked about it extensively on Elian. And
certainly that is an important issue, and I don't mean to just brush it off, but, you know, there are officials, you know, to talk about that, you know, and I'm here to talk about the campaign. And,
right, well,
and
all the issues.
Particularly about some of the issues that are going on right now, particularly in California and, you know, both nationally, but let's focus, you know, right now on the campaign in New Hampshire, if you will, or some of the specific things that are going on in California.
These are issues, and we are going to go to a break and come back to you. But one issue that has concerned, I think, people around the country, both with Al Gore's campaign and Bill Bradley's campaign and the Republicans, is the level of money that comes into their campaigns. And in the case, I believe, of Al Gore, more than $300,000 has come in from the right-wing Cuban-American community alone in Miami. And a lot of people are speculating that he would stand with Janet Reno in this, the attorney general, if it weren't for that money, and that it's hard to let's leave it at that. What is your response to that?
Well, you know, again, I can't, you know, comment on speculation like that. But, you know, again, obviously, you know, Al Gore wants the right thing to be done. And, you know, what I want to talk about more so is some of the, you know, the issues that are going on Outside of that, you know, in this campaign with Iowa, New Hampshire, you know, those two campaigns were extremely exciting, and I want to talk a little more about some of the issues that are going on in New Hampshire and
okay.
California.
Okay, and we will do that when we come back from our break. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're speaking with David Shea, who's the press secretary for the Vice President Al Gore campaign in California. We'll be back in a minute.
You know.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are on the line with David Chai. He's speaking to us from California. He's the press secretary for the Al Gore for President campaign there. Of course, Al Gore in New Hampshire today. He is stressing economic issues tonight, the last debate between him and Bill Bradley before the February 1st New Hampshire primary, the first primary in the country. David Shea, the issue of the economy and the issue of welfare reform. There are a number of critics of Vice President Gore and the president on the issue of welfare reform, people saying that basically the president ended welfare as we know it after 60 years of support for poor people in this country. What is your response?
Well, you know, what Al Gore clearly understands is that we need to, you know, make sure that there's economic opportunity for all citizens. And he wants to do that by focusing on the critical issues. Education, obviously, is the top because, you know, without an education, you know, you are severely lacking in opportunities. But, again, you know, the administration and the record, you know, we are clearly, you know, better off with this administration, and we're going to continue to move forward to provide economic opportunity and leave no one behind for the 21st century.
These are a series of tough questions, David Shea, but I'm sure you're used to them, or I hope you are, that journalists are really pushing the candidates. But last week, we did a whole segment on Democracy Now! On Occidental Petroleum and Al Gore. Occidental Petroleum, which is deeply involved with California. The Clinton administration presided over the biggest privatization of land in the U.S. in the history of this country with the sale of Elk Hills, this 47,000-acre area to Occidental Petroleum that the Republicans had been wanting to sell under their administrations, but because of tremendous opposition, were never able to do it. And it goes to the issue of Vice President Al Gore's holdings in Occidental Petroleum. I believe he owns more than $500,000 in stock. His father, very involved with Arm & Hammer and Occidental Petroleum. And this was all brought out in Charles Lewis's book with the Center for Public Integrity, The Buying of the President, 2000. Could you respond to that? Vice President Gore himself had suggested this sale of land at Elk Hills.
Well, I'm actually not as familiar with that particular issue, but, you know, I can follow up on that and get a little more clarity on that. But, again, you know, in terms of California, let me just say that it is clear that Californians understand that Al Gore is a leader that knows the critical issues here in the state. And, you know, just recently, let me give you an example for on Sunday, this last Sunday, we had our statewide caucuses, and we turned out overwhelmingly 3-1 support for Al Gore in terms of, you know, just grassroots supports from people from all walks of life, you know, from working families to different levels of ethnic minorities. And so the support in California and the understanding of issues, Al Gore is simply very solid, and his, you know, his support out here is just unrivaled.
Well, I know that there are protests today planned in New Hampshire around Vice President Gore's involvement with Occidental Petroleum. And we just got word in Colombia, because there are two issues. One is Elk Hills in California, this largest privatization of land in U.S. history with Occidental Petroleum buying, but also Occidental Petroleum's very questionable involvement in Colombia, particularly in the land of the Uwa, the indigenous people who in the past have threatened mass suicide if Occidental Petroleum drills. Well, apparently the Colombian military has just taken a group of Uwa from their land and taken them in helicopters and taken them away from their towns. And the Colombian government has just given Occidental the green light to drill in Uwa land. Now, I've been speaking to the White House and to the National Security Council about this and about Al Gore's involvement. They're saying this is new to them. You must know that there was this Financial Times piece in the last few days looking at Vice President Clinton's involvement with Occidental. And do you know what his stand is now on this, well, critical period for the Uwa in Colombia and Occidental Petroleum drilling there?
Well, again, you know, as the other official said, this is somewhat new to me too as well. So, but again, I just want to reiterate the issues out here in California, are very clear. You know, what we need right now is a leader that's going to show true leadership around, you know, issues around education, around crime, the economy, and the environment. And Al Gore has shown time and time again for Californians that he is there and he is willing to fight the good fight, you know, in providing more funding for teachers, you know, making sure that there's safer streets with more law enforcement. So Al Gore is very strong here in California, and his support remains very strong.
All of the questions I've been asking you are obviously related to money, related to campaign finance money. I mean, you've got the head of Occidental Petroleum giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democratic Party. You have in various cases, obviously, that situation. And no matter how much representatives talk about the issues, say buzzwords like education, unfortunately to become buzzwords, and healthcare, people want to know where the money's coming from and why the politicians aren't taking extremely strong stands on campaign finance and just saying take private money out of these campaigns. What's Al Gore's response to that?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly within the system, you know, as everybody has admitted, you know, desperately fought. You know, we do need to push for campaign finance reform. But, you know, if you look at it, you know, traditionally the Republicans, you know, are outspending us, you know, over 2-1. And what we need to do is, you know, work within the system. We need to obviously focus on campaign finance reform, but we also need to make sure that citizens out there are hearing the message and hearing what the candidates are talking about. And Al Gore has been fighting out there every day to get his message across in terms of, you know, education, you know, universal health care, really making sure that we're keeping this prosperity humming along for the 21st century and leaving nobody behind.
Finally, the issue of health care. What about single-payer health care? Vice President Gore did not support it, taking the insurance industry out of this, taking big business out of health care in this country.
Well, I would say that in terms of, you know, the scope of health care, that clearly the way that Al Gore sees, you know, this type of issue, he wants to make sure that, you know, the health care is affordable for everybody, and he's going to do that in a smart way, in a tactical way that's going to make, you know, these changes. But he's going to really focus on, making sure that no one is left behind, that children, you know, are insured and that families can afford health care. And his approach is the right approach. We're seeing overwhelming support here in the state of California for that. And we're going to continue to push for that.
Well, David Shea, we'll talk more extensively with, we hope, Al Gore himself in the coming weeks on these issues of health care, on crime, on the issues of police brutality, the kinds of issues that are not raised as much by the corporate press but are of very serious concern to people around the country. David Shea,
great.
Press Secretary for Al Gore, speaking to us from California. Thank you. And we turn right now over to Bill Bradley's campaign. Bill Bradley right now also... Bill Bradley also in New Hampshire. Bill Bradley is, trying to make up for what happened in Iowa. His spokesperson joins us from New Jersey, where the national campaign is. Jacques DeGraff is with us from New Jersey. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Good morning, Democracy Now. It's good to be able to tell our side of the story.
Well, why don't you lay out what it is?
Well, let's start that we are working from the national headquarters, so we've got a little bigger picture than one state, but that this campaign has achieved its goal. We said that we would try to meet the mark of 31% in Iowa. No insurgent candidate had ever achieved that goal. We got 35%. This is the most formidable insurgent candidacy in the history of the Democratic Party. Don't just take my word for it. Let's look at the facts. In New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, California, Maryland, we will be fielding full delegate slates in every congressional district in all of those major states and in every state in the country. We are prepared to go toe-to-toe with the Vice President of the United States in every congressional district. What that means is that he will have to answer questions before Democrats of all demographic stripe in this country in the days and weeks ahead. We are prepared to go in New Hampshire. You'll be seeing us across the country fielding a full campaign to take our vision and our message to the American people.
Let me play for you a comment that a political commentator made about Bill Bradley. This is Jim Hightower. He's the former Secretary of Agriculture mm-hmm. of Texas, and he's just written a new book, If the Gods Had Wanted to Vote, They Would Have Given Us Candidates. And in a recent speech he gave on the 2000 election, which he calls Space Odyssey, he talked about each of the candidates. This is what he had to say about Bill Bradley.
Bill Bradley has taken more money from Wall Street than any other candidate. He was a servant for 18 years in the U.S. Senate for Wall Street interests. He never stood for any of the issues that he now says are at the center of his campaign. Campaign finance reform, poor people, health care. Never heard him mention those things back then. Bill Bradley has more than 80% of his money coming from big contributors. His top six contributors, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan. When he left the U.S. Senate 4 years ago, what did he do? Did he go out and lead a crusade for campaign finance reform? Did he build houses with Jimmy Carter and Habitat for Humanity? No, he joined J.P. Morgan as a consultant, making $300,000 from them. Bill Bradley is a decent human being. Bill Bradley is a smart man, a sincere man. Bill Bradley can hit the jump shot from the post, but Bill Bradley is not going to stand against the powers that be for that workaday majority that has seen their income go flat and go down.
That was former Texas Secretary of Agriculture Jim Hightower on Bill Bradley. Can I get your response, Jacques DeGraff of the Bradley campaign?
Certainly. Jim Hightower is certainly entitled to his opinions. The facts say that 70,000 Americans have contributed to Bill Bradley's campaign, the most, formidable insurgency in the history of this country. People from coast to coast have contributed. And people on Wall Street have rights, too. They provide jobs, and they are only a reflection in a capitalist society of what we're doing. But Bill Bradley's campaign has attracted more contributors than any other candidate on the Internet. It has attracted contributors from coast to coast in the Democratic Party. Our fundraising effort was so significant that in the fourth quarter, we outraised the sitting vice president of the United States 2-1. And I think the most important thing to recognize is this. This campaign, and any campaign, is not a campaign between candidate A and a perfect individual in a perfect dream world. We live in a real world with real choices. The choices for Democrats in this year, 2000, are between Bill Bradley and Al Gore. And when you put the two side by side, a man of decency, compassion, and vision, we think the choice is clear.
Well, it's true that Bill Bradley, one of his first campaigns, Al Gore, one of his first campaign stops after first announcing for president in Tennessee, was on Wall Street. I was there as he made his announcement, surrounded by all of the buildings that represent economic power in this country. But that top 10 career patron list of Bill Bradley, being the number one recipient of Wall Street money is very serious. Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Time Warner, Prudential Insurance, the Walt Disney Company, Equitable Companies, Lehman Brothers, and may also go to a point when you see insurance companies, for example, that when he talks, for example, about health care and he would revolutionize health insurance in this country, why candidates like Bill Bradley and he himself don't push the issue of single payer, because they also represent the insurance companies, and this is just simply big business.
When you call off that roster of economic titans on Wall Street, it is nearly a tone that these are enemies of the American people. And that's simply not the case, since the American people are big stockholders in these companies, number one. Number two, it was Bill Bradley who put health care at the center of this presidential debate. It wasn't being discussed by anyone else. In fact, the mainstream corporate press that you talked about first criticized Bill Bradley for not discussing any issues. When he started to discuss the issues, they have become the centerpiece of this campaign. It was Bill Bradley who raised health care. It was Bill Bradley who raised children and poverty. It was Bill Bradley who put race at the center of this campaign. We're not going to apologize for the fact that we are able to attract the support, because without that support, we wouldn't be having this discussion. We're running against the Vice President of the United States. He gets on Air Force Two. He shakes hands with the President at the White House. He comes to states and is endorsed by the leadership of the party. And yet Bill Bradley has been able to outraise him in the money category. Bill Bradley has been able to out-organize him or equal his organization across the country. And so the focus of the message is not the past, but the future. Where are we going as a country? Where is the Democratic Party going to take people? And if we want to look at people's vision, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a man who has talked about leaving no one behind, and through his campaign has done that. In California, where I understand my opponents was speaking a little earlier, they talked about their outreach. Well, the fact of the matter is that we have more first-time people participating in the process than ever before. It really gets down to, who do you trust? The choice is not between Bill Bradley and perfection. It is not between Al Gore and perfection. It is between Bill Bradley and Al Gore. And when you look at Bill Bradley's record of integrity and decency and his commitment, I believe that you will say that the person who people will trust with their lives, with their future, and this country will be Bill Bradley.
What about the Elian Gonzalez case? Where does Bill Bradley come down on whether Elian Gonzalez should be sent back to be with his father in Cuba?
Well, Elian Gonzalez is obviously a troubling case, and it's a heart-wrenching case, and Bill Bradley has said on the record that he obviously wishes that that Elian's father could come and join him and stay in America. But this is a case now before the courts, and as a presidential candidate, we're not going to interfere with that kind of process and comment on that process. It does, however, raise these kinds of issues. It raises issues that at the same time the country and the furor is going on over Elian Gonzalez, a Haitian mother comes to the country under similar circumstances and has taken her children, are sent back to Haiti. It says, what kind of immigration policy do we have, and what kind of policy should we have? Those questions need to be raised in this race, and Bill Bradley is raising them.
Finally, the issue of race and the issue of police brutality. I know that in an Iowa debate, Bill Bradley challenged Al Gore to whether he would sign an executive order against racial profiling if he became president. And race has been an issue that Bill Bradley has talked about. But in terms of police brutality and in terms of people in prison, the disproportionate number of people of color in prison and on death row, what is Bill Bradley's stance?
Bill Bradley is very, very concerned about these issues. Let me start with, at the height of the Amadou Diallo case in New York City, it was Bill Bradley who came to New York and gave a speech on race. Race is not in the polls. Race is, when you poll any group, race does not appear as a major concern, and yet Bill Bradley raised that as a concern and spotlighted that issue. It's an issue that he talks about everywhere he goes. Bill Bradley talks about it in Iowa. He'll be talking about it in New Hampshire.
Is he for the death penalty?
He Yes, he is for the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
He probably does.
Also today in New York, three women are being released from prison. All have served more than 10 years for nonviolent drug offenses under, in New York, the very draconian Rockefeller drug laws. But there are laws like this at the federal level as well. Where does he stand on the hundreds of thousands of people in prison today who are serving these extremely long sentences for nonviolent drug offenses?
Well, Bill Bradley has talked about a new look at mandatory federal sentencing. And since this is my last question, I responded to your question, I just want to add one thing. As we listen to the choice, it's a clear choice for Americans. The choice is between Bill Bradley and his vision for the future and what my mother would have called that Pinocchio crowd that seems to have a difficult time taking the truth and building on it. Bill Bradley stands on his record. He has no apologies to make. He has been a U.S. senator, voted for in one of the most significant states three times. He's been a an Olympic gold medalist. He's been a winner, and he has been a person who has stood on his ideals and his principles for 30 years of service.
Jacques DeGraff, is he for the abolishing of mandatory minimum sentencing?
He's not for the abolishment of it. He's for a review of it, for a restructuring of it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Jacques DeGraff of the Bradley Campaign, and I hope it won't be the last time. Thanks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Of course, we'll continue to look very closely at the races. Again, February 1st is the first primary in this country, and it's in New Hampshire. Important to note that what are considered some of the most important primaries, the first, the primary in New Hampshire, and also the Iowa caucus that just took place, are in some of the whitest states in this country. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United States is opposing efforts by developing countries to expand the scope of a proposed agreement to regulate trade in genetically modified organisms, what's known as GMOs. The opposition comes as more than 360 delegates from 134 countries meet in Montreal for fresh talks aimed at agreeing on a biosafety protocol. If ratified, the protocol would produce an agreement among the world's main trading blocs on rules governing the international movement of genetically altered organisms. Repeated efforts to reach such an accord have stalled over the past 5 years amidst major disagreements between the U.S., Canada, and its grain-exporting allies, which oppose much of the regulation and environmental controls of the trade of GMOs in a group of countries that has included developing nations and the European Union. Similar talks held last year in Cartagena, Colombia, were suspended when the U.S. and Canada refused to agree with other countries' proposed biosafety regulations. Meanwhile, during the talks in Montreal, Greenpeace has charged the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C., with failing to protect the public health and the environment by approving a genetically engineered bacteria without adequate testing and against the advice of its own scientists. This happened in 1997. One member of the EPA's Biotechnology Scientific Advisory Committee resigned in protest of the process. Shortly after that, scientists from the EPA published a whistleblower report criticizing the agency's approval of the genetically engineered bacteria. Well, we're joined right now by Benny Herlin. He is head of the Genetic Engineering Campaign at Greenpeace International and is in Montreal for this international meeting. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Well, it's good to be with you. Can you start by talking about what this genetically engineered bacteria is?
It is a rhizobium, and these rhizobia form a cooperation with certain plants called legumes, such as alfalfa or soybeans, to fix nitrogen in the soil. They inhabit the roots of these plants, and the bacterium we're talking about is one of those that have been designed to enhance the yield for farmers. This has been done for quite a while with classical breeding of such efficient rhizobia as opposed to less efficient rhizobia. Rhizobia are in all soil, but farmers want their specific high-yielding rhizobia. And this was the first one that has been genetically engineered, actually. And the company has sought approval in 1995. And after this whistleblower report you talked about have been issued, the EPA initially said, well, we will put it on indefinite hold, the approval. But that only meant that they would duck and wait for two more years. And in 1997, without any additional substantial review of the problematic of this rhizobium, they have approved it. So it is now commercialized since 3 years in the United States.
Why did the EPA approve this without the support of the scientists?
Well, this is a question to probably put to the EPA in the first place. Our impression is that the EPA was and still is under enormous pressure to be seen as what you would call probably a can-do agency, an agency that delivers for the industry and does not hold up regulation but with regulation processes. This is my impression. I have no evidence of any direct intervention of the company or something like this.
Benny Erlin, can you talk about what's been going on in Montreal this week?
What has gone on so far is civil servants meeting in constantly changing clusters and groups and trying to find a solution to basically five contentious points with the Miami Group, as it is called. This is, as you said, the United States, USA, Argentina, which are the only three countries in the world that export GMOs at this moment, plus allies from Australia, Uruguay, and Chile. And their position is basically niet, 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 just like Khrushchev in the UN 40 years ago. They would not agree on any compromise on the question of what should be regulated, how should it be regulated, and who should be held liable should something go wrong.
I'm looking at a piece in the Washington Post from just a few days ago, from Monday, and it talks about the importance of genetic engineering in terms of feeding the world's population. It says, last week, for example, researchers announced they had created a new golden rice that contains transplanted genes to combat vitamin A deficiencies that can cause blindness in millions of children around the globe. What's wrong with genetically engineering a golden rice that can get rid of blindness?
Well, the case of golden rice is a good example of what I would call PR genetic engineering. Obviously, the companies have a problem to explain to citizens why this was necessary at all. And so the golden rice is a welcome example. The idea of the golden rice is to combat a vitamin A and also an iron deficiency, which comes from malnutrition and especially hurts children and also mothers. And first thing you have to say is that it is not treating the cause, of course. The cause is simply poverty and no access to fresh legumes or any animals to eat, where there is ample, where there is enough vitamin A. And the second thing to say is that the WHO, the World Health Organization, is conducting a program to fight this vitamin A deficiency since nearly 15 years now. They are lacking funding, and that's the only reason why vitamin A deficiency is still such a major problem. It costs them around 2 cents per child or woman or whoever to fight this vitamin A deficiency. They don't have this money. There are plenty of conventional methods with no genetic engineering available to overcome the vitamin A deficiency as long as it exists. Obviously, the longer-term solution is simply to give those people access to a more balanced diet. And also vitamin A deficiency is only the peak of the iceberg of a whole variety of deficiency even the golden rice would not combat. Now it has been engineered into a rice. This rice is yellow, and that will pose a major problem because especially in less educated regions, people will simply refuse to eat yellow rice because they are used to white rice. Also, an overdose of vitamin A can also cause problems. So if that was the only food these poor people get, they will create additional problems. And finally, what is not said in all these reports is that the commercialization of this rice realistically is a minimum of 5, more likely of 7 to 10 years away from now. So there is a solution, an instant solution now, which costs a little money, and this is not employed. And instead, they come with a techno fix in the sky of this golden rice, which actually does not address the real problem.
Benny Erlin, what about the people who are representing the different countries at this meeting in Montreal? You've got the environmental ministers of the European Union. In contrast, the U.S. has sent only lower-level civil servants. The chief of the U.S. delegation is David Sandilow, Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science.
This is correct. At the moment, we expect 50 environment ministers altogether to attend this meeting, which shows that a lot of countries are really taking this serious. It took us some effort to convince the Canadian Minister for the Environment, the representative of the hosting country, to come to the meeting at all. We have succeeded in getting him to Montreal now. We have certainly not succeeded to get any higher-ranking official from the United States. And this clearly expresses the attitude of the United States to this protocol. My feeling is that the United States administration at this point does not regard this as a democratic procedure between equal countries, but rather as something where they send a civil servant to tell the rest of the world what to do.
We're also joined on the phone, in addition to Benny Erlin of Greenpeace, by Agent Poptart, who is a spokesperson for Les Antartistes, a Montreal group equivalent to the Biotic Baking Brigade out on the West Coast. This past Friday, Agent Poptart pied Joyce Groot, president of Biotech Canada and president of the World Coalition of the Biotechnology Industry, as well as some other people. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Agent Poptart.
Yes, hello, gloop gloop.
Can you tell us who you hit this week?
Yes, actually, we kind of had a, well, still having an anti-GMO week. So we started on Friday with, as you said, Joyce Groot, who is president of Biotech Canada and president of the Worldwide Coalition of the Industry of Biotechnology. And on Monday morning, still on the same subject, we got Alan Rock, Minister of Health Canada.
Why? And what are you hitting them with?
Well, first of all, for Joyce Groot, we used fast food canned cream. So basically, there was probably some GMOs in it. But we thought that she wouldn't mind, basically, that she would be used to it. And also, we are very proud to announce that we were the first ones to voluntarily label our genetic modified food, because on the back of the plate was written BioPie. So we label it voluntarily, which we can't say as much for everybody in North America. So we pied her basically for the position that she is representing inside as well. Like if you go into Biotech Canada, they represent as well university research and development. So tax money goes into this, and they represent as well huge company like Monsanto, like Glaxo, Wellcome, like Beecham, like, you know, like all those really nice companies. And so basically we went there because they still stick to, well, first of all, we are against the fact that they are still proposing the voluntarily labeling measure, because obviously it's not working, because there are no GMO product that are being labeled in North America at this moment, and that measure has been proposed for a few years now, and secondly for the precaution principle as well. And then during the conference, Ms. Groot was saying that we wouldn't necessarily, as citizens, need to have the label on the genetically modified food, because Health Canada has approved all of this. So on Monday morning, we went to see Mr. Rock. And Mr. Rock is also, with Canadian, very concerned, I don't know if you heard, with the cigarette packs, because he forces cigarette makers to have huge labels on the cigarette packs, and now he wants to have, like, burned lungs and stuff like this on the packs. And we were asking Mr. Rock if he thought that this measure would work with cigarette manufacturer if it was voluntarily. So we kind of find that his position is quite irresponsible as Minister of Health Canada.
Which is why you pied him. What did you pie him with?
We had a merengue lemon pie.
And what was his response?
Oh, well, actually, Mr. Alan Rock reacted very, very well. So in that sense, it's all in his honor. He didn't took it badly at all. Mrs. Groot, I think, took it a little more badly. And we haven't seen the images around at all, really, here for Mrs. Groot. It's not the first time we've seen that kind of censorship. We had the Montreal Stock Market, Stock Exchange president, and at that time also as well, the pictures didn't, like, pass around on TV and everything. And it's a bit the same thing now with Groot, because I think we've touched a powerful lobby.
Have you ever been charged with assault?
Yes, we have. We're going on trial on March 31st and on April 6th for Stéphane Dion, which is Minister of Intergovernment Affairs. He came to a place called Chez Christo Pop, which is basically a place where poor people go and have some cheap food, and he was there to give away food to those people, and we thought that that was quite a thing, being in a government that just makes people poor all the time. So we went there to give him his dessert at the time, and he's basically one of the only ones that complain in 14 pies we've had so far here.
In addition to the pieing, environmental activists erected a giant ear of corn with jaws in front of the Civil Aviation Organization building in downtown Montreal, where the International Biosafety Conference is taking place, in protest of the growing international use of genetically engineered foods and crops. Benny Erlin, what's happening now in Montreal, though there are hundreds of protesters, does not, to say the least, compare to the battle in Seattle. Why the difference?
Well, I couldn't really say, first of all, but I think that people are not as informed
this
when
is Agent
it comes
Pop-Tart.
To GMO food. And you can see that when we went to the conference on Friday to buy Mrs. Groot, some people, some citizens were there and wanted to get in just because they wanted to have information on this, because we're not really all that informed.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We have been talking to Benny Erlin, head of the genetic engineering campaign at Greenpeace International in Montreal, as well as Agent Pop-Tart, spokesperson for Les Antartistes, the Montreal equivalent of the Biotic Baking Brigade, which has pied some of the biotech representatives as well as Canada's Minister of Health this week. During the international conference to write rules on the world's ever-expanding trade in genetically altered organisms. Can I get any websites from either of you?
Yes, R is a bit complicated, but if you go to any research engine, search engine, you'll find it at Les Antartistes.
And that's Entartistes?
Yeah, exactly.
And Benny Erlin, Greenpeace?
It's pretty simple. It's www.greenpeace.org.
That's www.greenpeace.org.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye. Yeah. Well, that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Cadion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. If you want to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can reach us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
There's a wave that's happening in the United States. People are getting incensed about this issue, which I think there should. There's never been any public...